Good afternoon. It is 12:02 on a Friday, July 1st, long weekend for many people. I'm Eric Scott. As usual, we have Senator Jeb Bradley in this slot. He's at a ceremony. Hopefully, we'll be talking to him when he's done with that. But with us also is State Representative and Governor Wentworth School Board member Brody Deshaies. Brody, how's it going?
It's going swimmingly, Eric. It's going wonderful. Yeah. I'm busy on the campaign trail, busy telling voters in Wolfboro and Tuftonboro why they should send me back to Concord. We've been having meetings with a number of stakeholders in the community, and a number of folks have come out and endorsed Representative McDonald and I, like a Register of Deeds, Lisa Scott. County Commissioner Terry McCarthy came out in support of John and I. Former Assistant Majority Leader of the Republican Caucus and Wolfboro State Representative Harold Parker. Former Wolfboro State Representative and Assistant Majority Leader Steve Schmidt. So we're gaining a lot of momentum. A lot of good positive things are happening on the campaign trail. We've earned the endorsements from some of our first responders, like the New England Police Benevolence Association, and I've earned the endorsement of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire. Standing up for first responders is something that I really prioritize. So it's going well. We have a lot of momentum. We're not putting out signs yet. It's still too early. We don't want to create litter on the side of the road at this point, but we'll get some signs out, you know, as we go through July, and we'll keep working. We'll let voters know what we've done, like decrease property taxes, invest in our communities and the infrastructure here, fight, you know, inflation with decreasing business taxes and ensuring that we make smart investments, standing up for the Second Amendment and protecting school choice. So a lot of great things.
That's funny. I wanted to talk a little bit about inflation as we start off this afternoon. And one of the things that I find interesting is that a lot of people are already saying the dreaded recession word, you know, the dreaded R word, that we're already there. In fact, if you were listening to the newscast at the top of the hour, it had mentioned that some economists already think we're there. There have been some big layoffs. Amazon is scaling down their hiring targets, as is the other company.
Well, scaling down hiring targets is not the same as layoffs.
That, but, you know,
so that just means that they're hiring less people in an economy with not a lot of labor.
Facebook had a layoff. Tesla had a layoff.
So the companies you're naming, though, Eric, are big companies that seem to have been growing too fast.
Right.
You know, and overextending their capital. Whether or not we're in a recession, that's a good question. I mean, you know, with almost everything, some economists say something, right? I mean,
good,
you know,
point.
Economists
okay,
take
yeah,
both sides
yeah.
of every issue and disagree or agree. You know, the only thing that most economists all seem to agree upon is, I can't even think of anything that every economist agrees upon. So I won't even go there. But, I think in New Hampshire, we're doing the best we can as a state to make sure that we have a strong business climate. And what does that mean? What does it mean to have a strong business climate? What does it mean to support the New Hampshire Advantage? Well, that means supporting reductions in business taxes and ensuring that businesses can do business and that they aren't overburdened with regulations. And so New Hampshire Republicans like myself, Representative McDonald and Senator Bradley, Governor Chris Sununu, have fought tirelessly to make sure that New Hampshire is number one in the country for starting a new business and number one in the country for doing business. And we're going to continue fighting for that. Not to mention, though, I've voted, and so has Representative McDonald and Senator Bradley. We've all voted not only to decrease our business profits tax and our business enterprise tax, but we also voted again this year to decrease the business profits tax, lowering it all the way down to 7.5%, which is huge. I mean, that's huge for businesses that are dealing with inflation. That's huge for them to be able to invest in their in what they need to do to serve their customers. It's also huge because they're going to invest in their labor force, and they're going to be able to offer a thing like hiring bonuses and things of that nature, and it's going to really help stimulate our economy. And every single time New Hampshire Republicans have voted to decrease business taxes since 2014, every single year after, we've seen higher revenues and we've seen revenues outpace expectations by the Department of Revenue Administration.
I agree with you, but here's my problem. When I'm dealing with $7 bacon and $5 gasoline, and in fact, the price of post office boxes just went up. A lot of people here have post office boxes.
Yeah. Well, that's completely unrelated to inflation. That's the postal service is becoming a lot expensive because the current people that run the postal service are, you know, trying to make it they're trying to make it so that it creates more revenue to offset its costs, to create less of a burden to taxpayers. And there's pluses and minuses to that. But I hear what you're saying, Eric, right? Inflation.
Right.
It's hurting me. It's a tax rate that everyone is paying on outlandish spending coming from Washington, right? Washington created this problem. And it's going to take some Washington solutions to fix this problem. And that's why this upcoming election really matters. It matters a lot, Eric, and the biggest reason is we need new leadership in Washington to rein in the reckless spending, make smarter investments, actually invest in hard infrastructure, not giant proposals where 80% of the money is going to special interest and to non-infrastructure spending, right? Real hard infrastructure investments and not infrastructure investments that the federal government deems is best for everyone, but block grants with wide interpretations for local communities to take advantage of, right? Most of the ARPA dollars that we've gotten in the state of New Hampshire has gone to local communities for local communities to spend. And it's those kinds of investments that our boards of selectmen are making that are going to decrease our property taxes, be the biggest thing that we can do in this state to fight inflation. Sadly, if I had a magic wand, if I knew of the state policies that we could pass in Concord to make bacon go down, to make the price of gas to go down, to do a whole host of things, I would do it. But in reality, there's not a lot we can do on the state level. However, what we can do is ensure that New Hampshire's the best place to run a business. What we can do is deliver property tax relief. Myself, Representative McDonald, and Senator Bradley, we voted to decrease the statewide property tax by $100 million to make it so that towns like Wolfboro and Tuftonboro are no longer donor towns, so we're not overtaxing our taxpayers, our property taxpayers, to ship our local tax dollars out of our school district. We want to keep that money here so we can invest it here. I want to make sure that every decision that's made with dollars that are raised, that the majority of those decisions, the majority of those dollars stay in Wolfboro and Tuftonboro, and that folks like Guy Pike and Bob Murray, or, you know, Brad Harriman and Dave Senecal, all who have endorsed Representative McDonald and I, that they're going to be making those decisions on how that money is spent, because they're going to make the smartest investments. So they're going to get the direct feedback from my constituents and their constituents. They're best suited to make decisions and to make those fiscal decisions, to make those investments locally. Top-down government control of things never works. The federal government, you know, the way that they made some of this ARPA money way too restrictive on our communities was not very fair. I'm hoping a new administration in the future and new leadership in Congress is going to change that, and that when they do need to send us money to help us make these kinds of investments locally, that they really consider, you know, what kind of tools do they need to be providing us, and what kind of restrictions should they be getting rid of, rather than making really restrictive rules and regulations behind how these dollars are spent to basically benefit specific industries. It's not fair, but, you know, I think our local boards have done the best with what they have. I know Wolfboro is making major investments, whether it's state grants that I voted for with Senator Bradley and Representative McDonald to provide more clean water and water treatment plants, whether it's, you know, the sewer system that's being updated because of ARPA money that the state helped pass along to our local communities, whether it's like in Tuftonboro, they need to fix the bridge on Mirror Lake. And, you know, myself and Representative McDonald and Senator Bradley, we helped support legislation, SB 401, I believe it was, to make it so then that there was increased in bridge funding, and not just bridge funding that comes through the state through the regular 5-year plan for bridge updates, but actual direct block grants to the town of Tuftonboro to help pay for that project. And it's these kinds of investments that are going to make it so that property taxpayers pay less, that their property taxes aren't going to outrageously increase, and that's going to help what the state can do to fight inflation. But at the end of the day, it's going to take new leadership in Washington to really tackle the root of the problem, which is too much money is currently in the system. Interest rates were way too low for way too long, and we need to make sure that we can constrict the monetary supply, kind of cool off the economy, and really get things back on track. And it's also going to take those states and the federal government to create a pro-business atmosphere, protecting the New Hampshire advantage, and ensuring that everyone is getting a fair shot and a fair opportunity in this economy.
Okay. It is 12:12, and we're talking with Representative Brody Deshaies with us this afternoon. Hopefully, Senator Bradley will be finished with his duties and be able to call in a little bit later on in this hour. Let me have you put on your school committee hat for a minute, and we were talking about inflation.
All right. State rep hat off.
Right.
School board member hat on.
School board member hat on.
Okay. We're ready to go.
Obviously, buses burn a lot of fuel.
Correct.
And price of fuel was probably not where it was when this got budgeted out.
Mm-hmm.
How is this going to affect the district when you've got to come up with X number of dollars extra that have to go into, you know, directly into the fuel expenses?
Well, now, Eric, I have to put on my rep hat on top of my school board member hat, because it's multifaceted, because the state is obviously involved in funding education. So I'm going to add that on top of my rep hat again. So obviously it's going to be tough, right? I'm on the school's finance committee and everything, the subcommittee that's going to help formulate the first draft of the budget. And then the school board, you know, we'll have public hearings and as a finance committee, and then the school board will have public hearings and everything, and we'll hash out and finalize the budget, which the voters will approve. The school board has always had our budget approved because we've been lean, right? Over the last 3 years, our budget has only increased about 4 or 5%, right? Not each year, throughout that entire 3-year time. And it's averaging only a little over 1% spending increase each year, because we pride fiscal responsibility in Wolfboro and Tuftonboro and all the other towns in the school district, Ossipee, Brookfield, Effingham, New Durham. We know that property taxpayers want a good bang for their buck, that they want a good investment, that they want a strong public education, but for the most affordable price that they can get it, right? 97% of students utilize Governor Wentworth Regional School District, right?
Right.
We need to make sure that those students are getting a strong, robust education. We need to make sure that the property taxpayers are getting a fair deal for that investment that they're making in our community. But you're right. I mean, fuel costs are huge. They're huge and outrageous. And again, it's top bottom sometimes. When Washington, D.C. creates outlandish mandates and makes it harder for more fuel production, it makes it hard to decrease fuel prices on a state level. We really have no control over, you know, the fuel supply in this country. Washington, D.C., they have direct power over that, whether it's offering more leases on public lands and making the price of a lease less expensive so then there's more oil and gas production or even coal production, which people also forget, too. The lease money on public lands, federal public lands, goes towards preserving our state parks. It's a huge part of the reason why we can preserve so much federal land and why the federal government's able to upkeep all of it. Expanding offshore drilling, that's going to be huge. There's new deposits and new things found offshore, new oil reserves, I should say, not things, oil reserves. And drilling for oil offshore has become so much safer than it was in the 80s, right? Nuclear is something that we need to tap into, right? We need to understand that if we really care about non-carbon options, nuclear is a huge way that we can actually start to divest from carbon if that's what states or what ratepayers really think is the best way going forward. I'm an all energy options kind of guy. We need all options on the table. We need to try to keep government away as much as we can. We need to provide competition in the market and stop picking winners and losers, right? Something that we've done on the school board level is, and this is before I even got on the school board, but obviously, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of this ARPA money, the American Rescue Plan Act, a lot of that money was really restrictive how you could use it. And it came out in three phases, especially for school districts. In phase one, it was pretty clear how we could spend the money. It had to do with getting the kids back in the classroom, make sure that there was, you know, PPE, safe, blah, 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 blah. You know, all the sorts of stuff that you need to make a safe environment. At least, you know, that's how it was 12 months ago, right? The second had to do with infrastructure. And specific infrastructure that it had to do with COVID. So we knew that we had to update a lot of our air systems in our schools. So with those schools, I think Senator Bradley's calling. I hear a phone going.
Yes.
Anyways, with those different, you know, air systems, we updated it and we made sure that our infrastructure was up to date because we knew that we're going to have to replace it within the next 5 to 10 years. And we said better to do it now with federal dollars than with property taxpayer money later on. Well, because of how restrictive all these ARPA grants were, it made it very, very difficult to find new projects to spend on because we had these other spending priorities, but it didn't qualify under ARPA. But one thing we did find, which how convenient from the Biden administration, is that you basically had free rein to spend it on renewable energy. And so we said to ourselves, well, we have an option. We can either send millions of dollars back to the federal government for it to go to New York, California, or other big spending wasteful states to spend it on whatever wasteful things they want to spend it on, or we can keep it locally and make an investment in our community. I would say it was a good decision to keep the money locally and invest it in our community. So what we did is we built a solar array in Effingham on public property, right? And after myself and Senator Bradley worked to pass a bill to allow municipalities and cities to net meter, it made it so then the amount of money that we get back from putting energy onto the grid was a lot more. And that solar array is going to help decrease the cost of electricity that the property taxpayers pay for in our school district. Right. So essentially what we did is seeing the fact that, you know, energy prices and inflation was rising, we said, well, as you mentioned, Eric, energy prices are increasing. It's going to hurt property taxpayers. We made an investment up front that said we're going to increase the energy production in our grid and we're going to get money back because we're going to, you know, get excess energy. You know, we're going to put excess energy into the grid and we're going to get money back. And that's going to help defray the cost of increasing energy prices for the property taxpayers. I think it's a smart investment to, rather than shipping our money back to Washington, D.C. to be redistributed amongst liberal states, that we kept it here and we made an investment that would decrease the cost of energy for our school district and ultimately decrease property taxes for property taxpayers across the entire school district. It was an ingenuitive way, and it was, you know, kind of the only option that we had when you really looked around at what the fact of the matter was, which was either give the money up or spend it and make a smart investment so then we're decreasing cost. And I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'm always for if we can make an investment that we know it's going to pay dividends later on and decrease taxes later on, that's a smart investment. Investments that don't create that are not smart investments. No one's going to invest money where they're not going to have some kind of rate of return. And that's how I look at every problem, that I'm not just looking at, you know, the immediate or right now, but I'm going to look down the future too, because that's what fiscal responsibility is really about.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. With us is Senator Jeb Bradley. Senator, good afternoon, sir.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Brody. Sorry to be a few minutes late, but just leaving the State House. The governor signed a bill I co-sponsored authorizing a Medicaid dental benefit for adults, and it's something I've worked on for several years. It took a lot of effort to get it across the finish line, but it is now across the finish line, and that's a good thing.
Now, if I understand correctly, there's always been, or at least there has been for a long time, a dental benefit for children.
That's correct, up to 18 years old.
Okay.
But if you were, you know, an adult, even if you were Medicaid qualified, there in New Hampshire was no adult dental benefit. And we've done it in such a way that the cost is fairly nominal. We're using money from the Centene settlement to pay for the first 3 years. And it really is, you know, a modest amount of money, somewhere in the $6 to $10 million range for this. But the benefit of it is pretty significant. Poor oral health leads to poor overall health. And if you're qualified for Medicaid already, and poor dental health is leading you to have diabetes or heart problems or other problems that can grow from poor oral health, those are, you know, treatable under Medicaid, but potentially avoidable. And so I think that, you know, in the overall scheme of things, it's going to be a very nominal cost, but a very big benefit, not only to the overall healthcare system tools that didn't have access to preventative dental care. And when you don't have it and your teeth are you know, not in good shape, it just means that not only is your overall health not as good, but your ability to hold a job and things like that, you know, becomes limited too. So, you know, it's sort of the same coalition that we had for Medicaid expansion where, you know, we had a lot of business support, we had support of healthcare advocates. In this case, you know, the dentists were 100% behind it. So governor signed it today, bipartisan legislation. We did it right. We worked the process to make sure that, you know, it was as cost effective as possible. As I said, we used, you know, settlement money from the Centene settlement to pay for the first 3 years. So I think overall it's a great package.
Well, congratulations on getting that bill done. Tell me a little bit about this Centene settlement that happens to be my insurance company. So I'm a little curious about it, to be honest.
So as I understand it, there were errors in billing, and as a result of a negotiated settlement, you know, the state received, I think, about $20 million back from Centene. And, you know, this was for people that are on Medicaid, and whether they're Medicaid expansion or traditional Medicaid, those funds should flow back, you know, to the state. I think if you're on Centene, you're probably in the, you know, private insurance market, whether individual or small group. So that wouldn't have been affected. But this was for the Medicaid portion of the people that Centene serves.
Okay. How were you able to solve the competing dilemma of reimbursement rates versus cost of the program?
So right now, a lot of dentists offer, you know, basically free dental care to a certain number of Medicaid patients. But they can't, you know, you can't run your practice that way where you meet the entire demand. So they have a handful. Most dentists will take, you know, a handful of those patients. They don't get reimbursed, but they're doing it as a community service, similar to, you know, general health care when people, you know, have an ailment and they have no insurance, and they show up at the hospital ER, and the hospitals have to treat them. So with this Medicaid dental benefit, while the reimbursement rate is not as high under Medicaid as it would be, you know, for either a private pay customer or if you have private dental insurance, when you're a dentist and you're, you know, suddenly getting whatever the amount is, but let's just say, for argument's sake, 50 or 60% of the cost, that's a whole heck of a lot better than nothing. So I think the dentists see it as an opportunity to provide better health from the for the patients that they serve, the areas they serve in, and it's, you know, going to help them and their bottom line, too, because they'll, as I said, even if you're only getting 50 or 60%, that's better than nothing.
Right. Brody?
I mean, I think this is another prime example of this is a smart investment to make to help decrease future cost. I mean, as the senator mentioned, you know, when you have a healthier society, it's less expensive for people who buy insurance, right? Their insurance deductibles and their rates are going to go down, and it becomes less expensive ultimately for us to fund Medicare and Medicaid in this state. I think the biggest thing too to remember is the state is required, right, under Medicaid to cover catastrophic costs for dental care. So what happens is if people don't get regular cleanings, they're more likely to have that catastrophic cost that we have to pay for. And when you make it so they get those regular cleanings and you decrease the number of catastrophic cases that they that were required to fund, we see actually a decrease in the long term. So just by making sure people have healthier teeth and better oral care, it essentially makes it so we have less catastrophic care to pay for later on, which is always way more expensive than regular cleaning. Regular cleaning is only probably anywhere from, depending on what the dentist, $50 to $125, where the average catastrophic care kind of bout or, you know, situation that you run into can run thousands of dollars, if not tens of thousands of dollars. I spoke to the chairman on the House side, Mark Pearson, about this. He's from, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head.
Hampstead.
Thank you, Senator. He's from Hampstead. And that's how he explained it to me was, listen, you're going to make an investment up front, but in the long run, it's going to decrease other costs by possibly millions of dollars. And when I see that, when I see, well, if we make a small investment up front, especially with, you know, for the first 3 years using the settlement money, and in the long run, we're going to have to pay less catastrophic care, to me, it's a win. It's a win for the taxpayers. It's a win for Granite Staters Health. It's a win for businesses that have less people out of the workplace, you know, getting this kind of catastrophic care done and having to recuperate. You know, instead, you just head off the problem right from the beginning. It's basically, we have a problem where we're cutting the problem off at the head of the snake.
Did you have a problem, Senator, with some Republican opposition to a bill that expanded Medicaid?
So there's always been a balance there on Medicaid. We've passed that bill three times, and, you know, we had pretty broad Democratic support for the most part. And Republicans, you know, there were some that were supportive and some that weren't. And I think that, you know, the ones that weren't, we tried to listen to them and address the concerns that they raised. Would Medicaid expansion ever become a liability of the New Hampshire General Fund for the portion of Medicaid expansion that we have to pay, which is 10%, which, you know, it's overall in the range of $400 million maybe on an annual basis, so the state has to pay 40%. But if the feds were to, for instance, lower the 90-10 cost-sharing, the feds pay 90%, we pay 10%, our program ends. We restricted general funds from being used to pay for Medicaid expansion. So we are using monies to come in from an insurance tax on premiums, which Medicaid expansion has a premium, so it is covered through much of the premiums that are being written, but also some liquor revenue went into it. So we kept it away from the general fund, and we put in work requirements. Now, the federal government, you know, nixed them. The Medicaid law federally did not allow for it per the courts. I'm not sure that I think that's the right outcome. I think there should be a work requirement, although we made it, you know, fairly easy to comply with. You could be a student. You could be taking care of a sick relative. If you had young kids, you were exempted, things like that. But when we, in 2018, put this entire package together, as well as, you know, a series of wellness incentives, and the best way to provide for people, you know, staying healthy is to provide an incentive. So for a Medicaid plan that, for instance, offers a voluntary payment if you, you know, get a flu shot, if it's a bad flu season, you don't have to do it. It's voluntary, but if you do it, you know, there could be a payment back to you. So we offered these incentives, and I think when we put the entire package together, we were able to win pretty significant Republican support. And I think that there were two other things that Brody sort of touched on them that were huge in passing Medicaid expansion all three times. We had broad business support. And the reason we had broad business support is, you know, it means a healthier workforce. If people have access to health care, especially preventative services or prescriptions that they may need or treatments that they need, they're more productive and they're able to stay in the workforce. So businesses benefited from it, and we had testimony in support of it from chambers and from the Business and Industry Association. The other thing that Brody alluded to is what I call the largest hidden tax in New Hampshire. And when you have people that are showing up, and even in this world of Obamacare, not everybody has insurance or they have high deductibles, for instance, if they have insurance, and maybe they haven't availed themselves of the options that they have, and then they get sick. And where do they go? They go to the emergency room, and they're often much, much sicker than they otherwise would have been had they been able to get preventative care. Well, guess what? The hospitals are required under federal law to treat people. It's usually more expensive treatment because, you know, people are sicker. And what happens? Those are dollars that don't just magically disappear, that the hospitals write off as charity care. They can't do it. They wouldn't be able to keep their doors open. We wouldn't have emergency rooms. What happens is when the hospitals negotiate their rates of what, you know, an Anthem or a Harvard or a Tufts insurance carriers pay them, the carriers understand that if, you know, they're not able to cover their costs because of all this free charity care, they're not staying open. The insurance product that they're selling is worthless because they won't have facilities. And so this uncompensated care, that's what we call it, gets baked into the rates that insurers charge to all the small group, you know, businesses that are in the 100 and under healthcare market or anybody in the individual market. So rates are much higher as a result of that. And, you know, when we first started to do Medicaid expansion, the uncompensated care was in the range of $400 million, which was showing up in everybody's health insurance bill that had health insurance. Because, and it was a hidden tax. It was a cost that was baked into those rates. And we have high health care costs. So I think that Medicaid expansion has helped us keep, you know, a lid on those high costs in New Hampshire. At the same time, it's provided for better health care. So those were all some of the dynamics that helped us put the bipartisan coalition together that we needed, you know, to pass it three times. And guess what? It's, you know, has to be reauthorized again next year. And I feel like after 10 years, the program has proven to be very successful. And, you know, we should be able to reauthorize it. And, you know, so one of my top priorities, assuming I'm fortunate enough to return to Concord, will be to make sure that we, you know, reauthorize Medicaid expansion. I think the federal government has kept their commitment at the 90-10 rate of reimbursement. So I feel like we're in a good place to do it. And I think it's very important for the overall health care of, you know, citizens in New Hampshire. I think the numbers are, you know, traditionally, you know, it's been about 50,000 people that have qualified for Medicaid expansion. And that's on top of the traditional Medicaid, which is at a lower income threshold. It's a 50-50 match of federal dollars and state dollars. And we've had that, you know, since the 1960s. You know, it's about 150,000 people that, you know, need this for their health insurance. And, you know, hopefully we'll have the wherewithal to reauthorize it on a permanent basis next year. I think it's very important. And, again, it'll be one of my top priorities.
Eric, I couldn't agree more with the senator. I used to be skeptical very much of the Medicaid and the Medicare expansion, but once it's explained to you as a public official or even as a candidate, you understand how smart of an investment it is in making sure that people are staying in the workplace, increasing worker productivity, making sure that businesses can reinvest in their workers. I mean, with a labor shortage, making sure we have people in the workplace, active, participating in the workplace, which is also why I support the work requirement for the Medicaid and the Medicare expansion in the state of New Hampshire. And, you know, it's called Granted Advantage, which I think is a great name because it really is a granted advantage. But I think ultimately, too, we have to remember what's on the ballot. And I think it's great that Senator Bradley brought up that, you know, this reauthorizing Granted Advantage, that it's going to be a huge issue that comes up next year. We have to remember what Republicans are actually paying attention to the dollars and cents and are not going to be penny wise and pound foolish. And that's why it matters what kind of groups Republicans associate with at this point. I mean, I know Representative McDonald and I, we're currently in a primary against a candidate who, two candidates who are members of the New Hampshire Liberty Alliance, who have opposed things like the dental benefit, which saves taxpayers money in the long run, which have opposed reauthorization of the Medicare and Medicaid plan, despite 90% of the plan being funded by the federal government, despite the fact the federal government will raise and appropriate the money whether or not we take the money. So it's better to bring the money into the state so New Hampshire can get its fair share of federal dollars. We send more federal dollars to Washington than we get back per capita of any state in America, and that needs to change. I mean, that's why our federal delegation needs to change. That's why we need new leadership in Washington, D.C. But in Concord, we at least need leaders who are going to stand up and say, listen, we need to make smart investments in Granite Staters that aren't going to break the bank, they're going to save costs in the future, and that it's going to be fiscally responsible. And I think myself, Representative McDonald, and Senator Bradley, with our votes in Concord over the past 2 years, and our continued votes in the future, if we're so, you know, if we're so grateful to be reelected, I think it really matters, right? We want someone who's going to be a champion, not only just of Republican and conservative values, but we want someone who's going to be a champion for Wolfboro and Tuftonboro and all of Carroll County and fighting to get the resources into our towns that we need. And it's more than just Granite Advantage, though. It's also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, property tax relief, ensuring that we keep more property taxes for education in our school district. It's about providing more grants to our towns and having more money being spent locally rather than by the state, right? Whether it's, you know, rebuilding bridges in Tuftonboro, like the Mira Lake Bridge that the Board of Selectmen are trying to find the funds for, and the grant money that Senator Bradley and I have helped delivered there, or if it's about wastewater treatment and helping get federal dollars and state dollars for a wastewater treatment plant in Wolfboro so we can have clean water, which drives our tourism industry in this state and drives our economy in Wolfboro, right? Without that clean water, no one would come and visit and vacation here. So it's those kinds of investments in empowering our boards of selectmen, our budget committees, to get money, to be able to spend it wisely with direct input from the taxpayers who live around here, rather than everything being a top-down approach from D.C. or from Concord. That's why I support local control, and that's why I have so much support from our local boards of selectmen and budget committee members.
Well, now that the Senator, now that the session is over, it looks like we're heading into campaign season. You getting geared up for that?
Yep, absolutely. Looking forward to, you know, knocking on some doors this summer and, you know, attending candidate forums. You know, I have a lot of responsibility helping other senators. Looking forward to, you know, marching in the parade and working with John and Brody, you know, through this campaign and then again next year. So certainly, you know, I think they both have done a great, great job. I've, you know, said how important Brody was for, you know, trying to get fixes to our bail law across the finish line. Came up a little short, which is unfortunate. But we'll be back next year, and that's why I think it's important, you know, to send people back that listen to voters who, you know, one of their top concerns is, you know, crime. And the ability to work with John on housing issues. He's on the Municipal and County Government Committee that heard, you know, a bill that I sponsored that hopefully we'll have a bill signing at some point in the near future with the governor that, you know, it's called the Community Toolkit Bill that makes it easier to get some of these multifamily projects approved just through the process. It's vitally important we upgrade our housing stocks. I think that, you know, Brody and John have, you know, done a good job, and those are just two specific issues that they've each worked on that, you know, I've worked on, and I've really enjoyed working with them.
How have you been able to, if you've even run into it, the, I don't want to use the term stigma, but the, some people are uncomfortable with the term public housing. You know, when you put up a bunch of affordable housing, some people automatically go to that. I don't think it's true, but some people do. Have you heard that, you know,
yeah,
heard some of that?
You know, Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, some towns in New Hampshire have, you know, low density zoning. In other words, like a minimum 1 acre, 2 acre lot size, or even larger in large areas of a town. And I get the, you know, local control is really important, but at the same time, you know, I look at a town like Conway that has addressed the issue through zoning, knowing that they've needed to build more workforce housing in, you know, their town if they're going to keep people working in the hospitality industry at restaurants and hotels, Cranmore, in their retail establishments. There's got to be, to say nothing of police and firefighters, teachers, there's got to be more workforce housing. And so the state has done a good job over the last few years partnering with developers through the Affordable Housing Fund to build, you know, private sector, higher density projects like Harriman Hill in Wolfboro. And the Affordable Housing Fund has helped lower the cost of capital, provided sometimes grants, you know, to move forward with this workforce housing, and it's been pretty successful. So not every town is going to adopt a more higher density approach throughout their town, but more and more towns, I think, are seeing the need for housing because they have to be able to have employees to work in a whole range of jobs that people have to work in. And if you can't have affordable housing, it's pretty hard to attract people to New Hampshire. And, you know, that is, you know, clearly one of the difficulties that our economy is experiencing now at a time that we, you know, are off the charts in a whole range of other metrics. Housing is an issue. That's why I've led the charge to dedicate $50 million over the last few years to the Affordable Housing Fund. That's been my legislation. It's why, you know, Governor Sununu came to me to sponsor the Community Toolkit Bill to expedite the process requirements of, you know, plans in front of the planning board. It's why the governor dedicated $100 million into, you know, a housing fund recently using federal funds. But, you know, there has to be a partnership between, you know, towns, cities, and the state. There has to be, you know, the maintenance of local control, but there also has to be an understanding that, you know, this exclusionary zoning is just very difficult to get the kind of housing stock we need in New Hampshire. So those are some of the, you know, dynamics that we face, but, you know, we are chipping away at it. The need is there. I think the business community recognizes that. Some of the biggest proponents of workforce housing are the realtors, the Business and Industry Association, Chambers of Commerce. You know, so I think as it gets, you know, more of a spotlight, we are going to be able to make more progress on it. So I feel confident that we will. It's certainly something, you know, I talk about my top priority being Medicaid. I think, you know, you've just identified, you know, something that's almost as high for me next year as, you know, Medicaid. And that's, you know, what we do to enhance our stock of workforce housing.
Okay. Brody, while we're talking about this, the one of the big things arguments I hear against large workforce housing developments is their proportionate impact on schools. As a school board member, you know, is there a balancing act that's ideal? I mean, we want to have people live in the community, but on the other hand, taking 75, 100 kids all of a sudden can get expensive.
You're 100% right, Eric, and I mean that's why Senator Bradley and I have supported legislation to increase the amount of adequacy aid given to school districts, which is huge. I mean that's going to help us fund education and make it more fair to everyone and help decrease property taxes. That's one. Two is each town is allowed to assess an impact fee. right? And the biggest things we have to remember is towns should assess the impact fee from the get-go of what they set for any, you know, any house or any kind of building and everything, because those impact fees are directly supposed to help defray future costs, whether it's infrastructure costs or the cost of educating a child. Right. And so those impact fees should be decreasing property taxes on everyone else, because the entire community shouldn't have to bear the burden of increasing the housing stock or, you know, paying for, you know, new students that are entering the school system that are kind of unanticipated in such a large volume. Right. That it should be kind of phased in. And that's what impact fees are for and everything. And, you know, that's a local tool that we give to our communities to really be able to deal with this issue in a specific way. Another example, though, is Senator Bradley's SB 400, right, which was a bill that was to help improve the housing stock and improve the amount of housing in towns across the state of New Hampshire. It was really strongly backed by Governor Chris Sununu, and I voted for it also. Actually, no, I don't think we ever got the opportunity to vote for it on the House side, but I voted for the original version of it, House Bill 586, the year before. And what that bill would have done is it would have provided incentives to communities to update their planning and their zoning ordinances to make it so then that it was more, that their towns were more favorable to light development, you know, kind of to development for housing. And the biggest thing that that bill did, though, was not only provide, you know, incentives to towns, but also backed it with grant funding if you're a town that was, you know, a housing champion. And that's huge, the state being able to defray any cost to property taxpayers, because that's usually the biggest complaint, right, against this housing expansion. And it's, you know, education's one example that's brought up, but infrastructure needs is another thing that's brought up. I mean, Wolfboro's sewer system and water system is just about maxed out. Right?
Right.
Trying to put in an affordable housing project would be next to impossible unless the impact fees were increased. But if the state can help provide an incentive or at least decrease the overall cost of having to expand water and sewer, it'd be a great win for the town of Wolfboro. We'd be able to update our water and sewer system, expand it so then we could add more homes to it, which is, you know, makes it less expensive to operate, and would make it so then we could have affordable housing too. I mean, you're hitting a whole bunch of things. So again, ultimately, though, for all this to happen, we need to have a strong business climate. We need to defend the New Hampshire advantage. And that's why Senator Bradley and myself have voted to decrease business taxes. It stimulates our economy. It increases our revenues. When we have a strong economy, when we have a strong business climate, we can make the smart, pragmatic investments that are needed, whether it's granted advantage, right, the Medicare and the Medicaid expansion, whether it's a dental benefit, whether it's, you know, reform to the pension system to treat our first responders and our police officers justly, or housing, right, and providing grants to help towns defray the cost if they adopt more favorable zoning and planning ordinances to be able to develop more affordable housing. To do all of that, we need to have a strong, robust economy. We need new leadership in Washington to help us do that. But we need Republicans with a proven record of decreasing taxes, whether it's property taxes, business taxes, the meals and rooms tax, and also ensuring that we're delivering more property tax relief.
On that subject, Senator, I just heard recently that school adequacy is making it through the courts again, or there was a recent court decision.
Not a recent court decision, but a new lawsuit filed by Andy Valinsky that'll probably be combined with a Conval suit that'll go before a judge next spring. We'll see what happens on that. Look, I know it's been a focal point of discussion among a lot of people since the Claremont decision in the late 1990s. Under that decision, I had an obligation, according to the court, to fund an adequate level of education. It's roughly about $4,500 when all is said and done. The adequacy grant's $3,700, but then there are provisions for English as the second language, third grade reading abilities, things like that that bring it up. But it's roughly in that $4,500 range. Now, we all know the cost of educating a child in New Hampshire is, you know, maybe three and a half times that, in the $15,000 range. In some communities, it's even higher. So there are, you know, some disparities between towns. And so the proponents of, you know, overhauling the system have done a good job of maybe highlighting those disparities. So I will give them that, okay? But where they all fall down is on the solution. What are you going to do? How are you going to take, for instance, a state grant from around $4,500 to about $10,000, which is what they want? There's no way to do it unless you totally upend the tax system in New Hampshire. And that means an income tax, maybe combined with a sales tax, or a sales tax combined with possibly an income tax or a hefty capital gains tax. And you might be able to scratch your way, you know, to that level of grants. Or what I think is more likely to happen, because it happened in the past, is that we recreate donor towns. And so you would have all of the Lakes region, much of the Mount Washington Valley, much of the, you know, area in the mountains of New Hampshire, the seacoast, certain areas and other towns that suddenly their property tax, statewide property tax dollars are no longer retained locally, but they're going as a quote-unquote donation to other communities. And that, you know, was wildly unpopular. So my view has been, it is an issue, okay, which is why in the 2019 budget, we dedicated $140 million of new money to education. And in the, you know, this cycle, another $125 million to education. That's how we increase that adequacy amount. And I'm in favor of that. We got, you know, rid of the 4% reduction that was going to phase out stabilization grants. We've added, you know, more funding, you know, for capital projects again in schools. So these are all things that the legislature has done. And overall, I mean, I know Brody stressed this before I got on the show, we have sent back $500 million to cities and towns, whether with water and sewer grants, whether it was funding from the rooms and meals tax revenue, whether it was helping with the cost of retirement. We've sent back $125 million of more money to schools. We've sent back money to the counties. We've sent back overall that $500 million range. I think that, to me, and this is, you know, you're asking, somehow we got off on priorities for next year. This will be my third priority, is we have to keep our economy strong at a time when Washington is doing everything to undermine it, whether it's high energy costs, high inflation, crime, open borders, fentanyl problems, you name it, the costs are accelerating and the economy is likely to go into a recession. So we need to do the best we can to make New Hampshire as competitive as possible. And if we're able to continue to generate the revenue surpluses that we've enjoyed for the last few years, that money should get plowed back into property tax relief. It won't all be education, but a good chunk of it will be. And that is the best way, in my humble opinion, to fund education in New Hampshire. You want an income tax? Okay. Your overall tax bite in New Hampshire is going to go up. We're among the lowest, you know, per capita state tax and local tax rates. So combination of state taxes and property taxes, I think we are the 16th, you know, highest, or 16th best, I'm sorry, in the country. The next best state to New Hampshire in terms of overall tax burden on its residents is Rhode Island. At 36th best. And then you have Massachusetts and Connecticut and Vermont and Maine and New York and New Jersey that are all higher. So we are an island in the Northeast of sanity in terms of our economy. And we've used it to generate budget surpluses. We're going to have, you know, we have $400 million of excess revenue right now in the rainy day fund. We've filled it. We've had to raise the cap to make sure that we could take more than what the cap limit was before, which was $150 million. You know, now we have that $400 million in it. We're going to use some of that for help for people with their energy bills because Washington, again, you know, asleep at the switch and, you know, energy prices are soaring and home heating oil is, you know, that season's going to be upon us really quickly, despite the fact that today's the hottest day of the year so far. Keeping the economy strong in a recession has got to be a top priority. That helps us fund everything.
So you think we're in a recession at this point?
I think we're getting there pretty quickly. I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to see what the second quarter GDP numbers are in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, the first quarter showed a shrinking in the economy by, I think, 1.4%. If we have another shrinkage in the economy in the second quarter, that is a recession. And when you combine that with the fact that people are spending less now, you know, because they're afraid of what's happening, that's going to slow the economy. When you factor in, you know, the continued escalation in costs for everything, not just energy, but food and other services, you know, the costs are rising. Inflation is a hidden tax that's going to hurt the economy. Look at what's happened in the stock market in the, you know, last month. This is, inflation has become pretty obvious, you know, what the problem is. I mean, trillions of dollars of lost asset value for Americans. So I think that, yeah, we are in all likelihood looking at a recession. I hate to say it, but the thing that I want to stress, Eric, is that what we've done in New Hampshire, and Brody, you know, deserves a big amount of credit along with John for, you know, working with myself and Senator Morris on, and the governor on the budget packages that we put together that have made New Hampshire competitive and have led to a strong economy. We are in much better position in New Hampshire to weather a recession than other states. And having an income tax, a sales tax, a capital gains tax, or God forbid donor tax is the worst thing that we could do as we, you know, start to talk again about education funding for the next budget. That would be, that'd be a killer for the New Hampshire advantage. And the New Hampshire advantage is what has driven, you know, the good numbers, the surplus that we have, and the ability that we've had over the last few years to dedicate more revenue to education.
All right. Unfortunately, the clock is not our friend, and we have run out of time, Senator. Thank you for taking up your time again, and I hope you enjoy your holiday weekend.
Same to you, and looking forward to being in the parade with Brody and John.
Yeah. All right. You take care. Thank you very much. Brody, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Eric. And again, I just want to remind everyone, I know the senator just reminded everyone, but look forward to seeing you in the parade. It'll be myself, Representative McDonald, and Senator Bradley. We have 4,600 lollipops. Please, take some lollipops in the parade. I ordered too many. I guess I added a zero. It was a lot more than I was expecting.
I guess so.
You'll see us in the parade. Take a handful of Dum Dum lollipops. Have your kids take a handful, but it's going to be fun. July 4th, 10 a.m., downtown Wolfboro. Don't forget, there's a parking ban in the morning. If you have questions about the parking ban or handicap accessibility, call the town manager, call the town clerk, Jim Pinio, Pat Waterman. We're going to have a great blast, though. It's going to be a great week. I know, Eric, it's time. Thank you for having me.
All right, it's 1 o'clock.